Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are discussing how law enforcement deals with white supremacists inside and outside police forces. At a June 2016 white nationalist rally in Sacramento, an anti-fascist counter-protester was stabbed and bludgeoned. She was a Berkeley teacher and an anti-fascist organizer, and she was charged with assault and rioting. The Guardian recently revealed documents indicating that California Highway Patrol officers worked with neo-Nazi rally participants, treating them as victims and anti-fascist counter-protesters as suspects. Law enforcement responses to violent white nationalists and neo-Nazis at rallies across the country has been tepid. Many police departments don't track hate crimes, and very few have good training for officers on how to deal with hate groups. Also, the FBI has investigated attempts from white power groups to infiltrate the ranks of police departments. White supremacists maintain an active presence in U.S. police departments and other law enforcement agencies. This is according to a classified FBI counterterrorism policy guide from April 2015, which was obtained by The Intercept. So how widespread is this, and what is being done about it? Today, we are joined by A.C. Thompson, a reporter at ProPublica, where he covers criminal justice. AC and his colleagues have been covering hate crimes and white supremacy groups. Hi, AC. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Professor Samuel Jones, professor at John Marshall Law School in Chicago. In 2015, Professor Jones wrote an article called Law Enforcement and White Power, an FBI Report Unraveled. Hi, Professor Jones. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're also joined by Sam Levin, staff reporter with The Guardian. Sam's story exposed Sacramento's CHP's interactions with a white nationalist group following a 2016 rally that turned violent. Hi, Sam. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Sam, I want to start off with you and talk about the report that you ran just a couple of weeks ago called California Police Worked with Neo-Nazis to Pursue Anti-Racist Activists, according to court documents. How did you get tipped off of this? How did you find these documents?
So these documents came out in the prosecution of these counter-protesters, the anti-fascist activists, as part of discovery. And so through that process, it was revealed that, you know, the police had had pretty close communication with the white supremacist groups in working to bring charges against the leftist activists. And emails were revealed and recordings of phone calls. And the sum total picture was that the police were largely expressing sympathy to the white nationalist groups and were targeting the anti-fascist activists for prosecution.
You also found, according to the records, that the officers were trying to protect a neo-Nazi organizer's identity. This was included in a court briefing from three anti-fascist activists who were charged with felonies after protesting at the rally?
Correct, yeah. And so in that case, there was evidence that police officers had essentially called one of the leaders of the white supremacist rally and said, you know, there's a public records request and the folks might be trying to get your name, but we'll do our best to kind of help you out here and make sure your name doesn't get out there. And, you know, we're looking at you as a victim. And so this was obviously pretty stunning to the anti-fascist activists, who were surprised to see police, you know, working quite closely and sympathetically with these groups.
We called the CHP in Sacramento and asked them to join us. They declined our invitation, but they gave us a statement saying that the June 2015, 2016 incident began when a group of two dozen people from the Traditionalist Workers Party obtained a permit to hold a rally in the west area of Capitol Park. Other groups present that day attempted to prevent the rally. The confrontation led to violence and moved onto state property, resulting in 14 reported injuries and thousands of dollars in property damage on Capitol grounds. Following the incident, the CHP conducted an eight-month-long joint investigation with the Sacramento Police Department into the events, and the findings were submitted in a more than 2,000-page report to the Sacramento County District Attorney's Office for their review. This is a statement from the CHP. They declined our invitation but sent us a statement. Sam, what did you learn in that 2,000-page report? Or have you seen it? Did we lose Sam? Sam, are you still there?
Oh, I'm still here. Yeah, can you hear me? Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
So in terms of the evidence that came out in the court, again, it was sort of repeated cases of these phone calls between police and the white supremacists in which they were saying, you know, we want to assure you that we are looking at you as victims. And in one case, they sort of work with them to specifically try and identify as many of the counter-protesters as possible. The prosecutors, you know, sort of in response to some of my reporting and in response to the claims of the anti-fascist activists, have argued that, you know, there was no bias in the way that they approached this case and that, you know, they were just going where the tips led them. But in terms of sort of the language they used, there was a feeling amongst the counter-protesters that there was a clear bias and that, you know, they were working to sort of protect the white supremacists.
How common is this, Sam? There's a lot of extensive reporting has been done now that we're seeing so many of these rallies across the country. But how common is this? Do you know?
There's been numerous examples across the country in these sort of anti-Trump or anti-fascist rallies and events in which you see police working closely with the white supremacist groups that are trying to organize these events in the first place. And so there is this, you know, repeated kind of allegations of collaboration between police and fascist groups in terms of kind of providing them protection and targeting anti-fascists for prosecution. And so similar claims have come up in Charlottesville and as well as the sort of inauguration day protests that happened in D.C. On the day of Trump's inauguration.
Where is this story going from here, Sam?
I think this trial will be very interesting. You know, it remains to be seen how this will play out. It's definitely ongoing and will drag on for some time. The prosecution has pretty strongly denied these claims and has, you know, attempted to have the case move forward while the defense here has argued that it should be dismissed because of this bias. But I think you'll see more come out when police officers are, you know, called to testify and the California Highway Patrol have to answer questions about their kind of communications. But certainly we've also seen evidence of, or cases and examples of anti-fascists across the country facing pretty intense prosecution and stiff sentences. And so that seems to be what they're pursuing here in California as well.
Well, thank you for joining us, Sam.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Sam Levin is a staff reporter with The Guardian. You can read his piece, California Police Worked with Neo-Nazis to Pursue Anti-Racist Activists, according to court documents, at yourcallradio.org. We did reach out to the California Highway Patrol. They declined our invitation, but they sent us a statement. AC Thompson, you have extensively reported on this specific issue. How common is it for police departments, highway patrol departments, to work with white supremacist groups to try to, you know, arrest anti-fascists?
I mean, I think the first thing that we're seeing is that if we're having that discussion, then there has already been a massive law enforcement failure. When you look at Sacramento, when you look at the protests in Berkeley, when you look at the protests in San Bernardino and Huntington Beach and Charlottesville, Virginia, what you see over and over and over again is
AC? Did we just lose AC? AC, can you hear us?
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so what I was saying is in all these protests from Sacramento to Charlottesville to Huntington Beach to Berkeley, what you see is just absolutely abysmal preparation and planning on the part of law enforcement before the events happen. And so that means that anti-fascist groups and neo-Nazis are able to directly interact with one another, bring weapons to the site, improvise weapons, and get an insane, horrible Game of Thrones-style battles. The initial failure by law enforcement is not to expect that there will be conflict between those groups, not to prepare for it, and not to prevent it. If you have a 2,000-page report...
AC, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can you bring your microphone closer to your mouth?
Can you hear me now?
Much better. Thank you.
Okay.
Great.
So if you have a 2,000-page report on what's transpired at a protest, you have a problem. You should not have that. You should be able to prevent these things before they turn into bloodshed.
I want to bring in Professor Jones. Professor Jones, you have been studying this issue for a long time. You have written about it. We're going to talk about white supremacists inside of police forces throughout the show. But can you first talk about what we know about police forces working with white supremacists at some of these rallies that we're now seeing?
Okay, so... Well, let me go back to the FBI report, because the FBI report, as you mentioned, there was one several years ago, but the FBI actually came out with a report in 2006, which really shed light on this problem. So this problem has actually been much more severe than what we think. This has been going on for over a decade. And in the October 2006 report, what the FBI warned was that white supremacists were infiltrating law enforcement agencies across the country. And what we saw was that between 2008 and 2014, the number of white supremacist groups in the United States grew from about 149 to nearly 1,000. So the problem has continued to worsen and has spiraled with no apparent abatement in sight. And so when we're talking about Sacramento, we have to understand that this is actually a problem that's facing major cities all across the country. And so when we talk about the rally, that is just one aspect or manifestation of the problem. There are people being stopped. There are people being hurt in jail. There are people who are being sexually assaulted. So the white supremacist manifestation or infiltration of law enforcement is not really unique to the rallies. It is actually something that, for those of us who've actually been studying this issue for several years, I see it, and I'm not surprised by it, because it pretty much permeates every aspect of law enforcement. Whenever there's interaction between law enforcement officers and certain communities inside the country, namely racial minority groups, religious minority groups, and social minority groups.
That is Professor Samuel Jones. He's professor at John Marshall Law School in Chicago. He wrote an article in 2015 called Law Enforcement and White Power, an FBI Report Unraveled. He's referring to FBI documents from 2006 warning that white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement represented a significant national threat. At that point, members of an L.A. sheriff's department had formed a neo-Nazi gang. A Chicago detective revealed as a Klan member was fired from the police department after torturing more than 100 black men. AC, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, I'm finding lots of articles about these stories, but when you connect the dots, when you look at the 2006 report, when you look at the 2015 report, and then we're learning that police departments are working with white supremacists at these white nationalist rallies, what do you come up with when you connect the dots?
I think there's another element that I would add to that, too. And I think one of the things that is concerning to me when you see that pattern and you add this to it is the sense that you have both infiltration and ignorance about these groups. And so I think the thing I want to add to that is that I do not believe that federal law enforcement agencies or state and local law enforcement agencies generally have a very good grasp on the new white supremacist movement. I think generally they don't understand it. I think generally they do not have people within the movement. I think generally they are not watching it very carefully. And so you have the infiltration of white power groups. You have questionable practices around protests. And then I think you have the last piece, which is that just in general, there's not a lot of interest in monitoring these groups, in infiltrating them, investigating them, and prosecuting them. So you see a sort of whole panoply of problems.
Do you think society at large has any idea what's happening with these new white power movements?
You know, I honestly think there's maybe better comprehension by the public in general than by a lot of people in law enforcement circles. When I read FBI and DHS intel bulletins about this subject, they feel like they're 2 or 3 or 10 years old. They're not dealing with the new white power movement that's out there. They have not adjusted to it. But when I interact with people on Twitter, they are monitoring it very closely, and they see where these groups are popping up, and they see what social media platforms are giving them a platform. And so I think in some ways, the public in general is more educated about these outfits than many in law enforcement.
Professor Jones, I know we had to find you a better line. AC was saying that he thinks the public understands these new white power groups more than law enforcement. And what do you think we need to understand when we look at the big picture? When we look at the reports from 2006 and 2015, and now the new reports coming out about police departments working with white supremacist groups at these white power rallies?
So one of the things that I think is very important to understand is something that the FBI pointed out in both reports. What they specifically said was that the threat is not simply police officers being members of these groups. The bigger problem is police officers being in sympathy with these groups. And so what that means is that you might have a lot of police officers in, within a department who actually are in sympathy with these white supremacy groups. They are not an active member, but they understand. They want to support them, but they simply do not take an active role in membership. But they don't bend over backwards to arrest them or to investigate them. And so that sympathy is what the FBI points to as our greatest threat, because that allows these white supremacist groups to operate with absolute impunity. I think that one of the things that I think the public should understand is that white supremacist threat is not simply limited to excessive violence or unlawful use of force, you know, during a traffic stop or at a rally. This also permeates, you know, through many sectors across many communities. For instance, there's been widespread reports from undocumented immigrants of the sexual assaults that they suffer at the hands of law enforcement. Okay, there's been a lot of there was a police officer in Houston who was targeting African-American females. There are children who are targeted, children of rich minorities who are targeted. So a lot of times when we think of white supremacists, we think of the KKK and burning a cross on someone's laws or on someone's lawn, or someone being stopped or killed at a traffic stop. But the manifestation of that hate is much larger, and it manifests itself in various ways and across all kinds of spectrums. And I think that the public really needs to be aware of the various manifestations of that. One thing I will say is that we should also be mindful of the fact that the blue wall of silence, this idea that police officers never tell on one another, is a major threat to all law enforcement, to all public officials and basic citizens. Because what that means is that even when good police officers who may be law-abiding when they're doing their job, if they become aware of another police officer who might be working in concert with a white supremacist group or might be in sympathy with a white supremacist group, they are not going to report that police officer because of this culture within law enforcement that pretty much demands that they don't, that they not tell on one another. And that is a very serious threat to any to our ability to detect deviant police officers across all spectrums.
Samuel Jones is a professor at John Marshall Law School in Chicago. In 2015, he wrote an article, Law Enforcement and White Power, an FBI Report Unraveled. We're also joined by A.C. Thompson, a reporter at ProPublica, covering criminal justice and these issues. Today, we are talking about how law enforcement deals or doesn't deal with white supremacists inside and outside police departments. White supremacists maintain an active presence in U.S. police departments and other law enforcement agencies, according to a classified FBI counterterrorism policy guide from April 2015. It was obtained by The Intercept, and then FBI documents from 2006 warned that white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement represented a significant national threat. Later in the show, we'll be joined by Norm Stamper. He was a police officer for 34 years and served as Seattle's chief of police. He's now focused on police reform and social justice policing. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. We have done a lot of shows about police reform and community relations. This is one issue that does not get that much attention when we're talking about things like unconscious bias. I mean, if we're talking about white supremacists working in law enforcement, how widespread is this? How should this be dealt with? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Professor Jones, in the piece you wrote, you cited a number of specific examples. For example, a United States District Court found that members of the L.A. Sheriff's Department formed a neo-Nazi gang and habitually terrorized the black community. This was in the FBI report in 2006. Later, the Chicago Police Department fired John Burge, a detective with ties to the Klan, after discovering he tortured over 100 black male suspects. The mayor of Cleveland discovered many of the city police locker rooms were infested with white power graffiti. Okay, so that was in 2006. How do we find out what is happening today if police departments are not vetting police officers?
So one of the things that I think is a very important vehicle for discovery is Freedom of Information Act requests. That's one of the things that the public can do, because police officers are public agencies, and so there is some information that you can glean from those kinds of reports. The other thing that I think is very important for every citizen or agency to be involved, or who cares about this problem, to do is when you come across a behavior by a police department, or for instance, let's say the Sacramento Police Department, who issued this 2,000-page report, and their conclusion is that, you know, their officers were acting within the bounds of law, look at the, make an inquiry as to how many officers have been terminated or disciplined because of racist behavior or racial bias or racial postings on Facebook or within social media. And what you'll find is that very few officers are actually disciplined for racist conduct. For instance, in Chicago, where we've been known to have a tremendous amount of problems involving racism, only one officer in the last 50 years has been terminated for conduct linked to racism. So that, to me, is one of the biggest indicators of what kind of police department you have when you don't see a history of disciplining officers for racist conduct. The other thing that is very important to understand is that one of the problems we have with police is that too often they are not terminated but allowed to resign. And so by allowing police officers to continue to resign when they commit heinous acts, it allows them to simply get another job at another department in another city or another county. And so that department takes on this problematic officer. That department is unsuspecting. That local community is unsuspecting of who that officer actually is, because we don't have a national database that tracks white supremacists, nor do we have a national database that tracks police officer misconduct generally. So this is really like a secret society, and so we not only see police officers engaging in very bad conduct, they're simply allowed to resign and go to other police departments, and so we have a very unsuspecting public.
AC, given that there are no databases, as a journalist who extensively covers these issues, how do you go about getting this information?
Yeah, the hard way. I mean, through sources within the white supremacist movement, from law enforcement sources, from internal private documents that these groups circulate. You know, in the most recently, my team and I have been working off 250,000 chat messages that were passed around by members of the Adam Waffen Division, a neo-Nazi terrorist group. And so that's how we know what their true intentions are. That's how we know what they want to do. That's how we know about the crimes that they've been involved in. But it's not easy to do. And I will say, you know, my colleagues and I know that there are some in law enforcement who are very concerned about this. We know that there are people throughout the government that have raised concerns about this over and over again. But I think generally there has been a sort of myopia when it comes to the threat that these groups pose, both to law enforcement and the public in general.
AC Thompson is a reporter with ProPublica covering criminal justice. He and his colleagues have been covering hate crimes and white supremacy groups, and you can find his latest pieces, including one called Racist Violent Unpunished, a white hate group's campaign of menace, at yourcallradio.org. Samuel Jones is a professor at John Marshall Law School in Chicago. You can also find the piece he wrote, Law Enforcement and White Power, an FBI Report Unraveled, at yourcallradio.org. Today we are discussing how law enforcement deals with white supremacists inside and outside of police forces. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss the case of two Reuters reporters who've been jailed in Myanmar. They were investigating the killing of 10 Rohingya Muslim men. We will also discuss the Supreme Court case that could deal a massive blow to organized labor across the country. That is tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about how law enforcement deals with white supremacists inside and outside of police forces, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. Leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Tweet us at yourcallradio. There are lots of ways to get in touch and join the conversation. Today, we're joined by A.C. Thompson, a reporter at ProPublica, covering criminal justice and these issues. Samuel Jones is a professor at John Marshall Law School in Chicago. Now I would like to welcome Norm Stamper to the show. Norm Stamper was a police officer for 34 years and served as Seattle's chief of police. He is now a writer, speaker, and trainer focused on social justice in policing. Hi, Norm. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, it's good to have you back. There's so much reporting on these issues, Norm, and we have a question that I've been thinking about, too, from John on Facebook. What standards and criteria are in place for designating a group as a white supremacist group? How would you answer that, Norm?
Well, I think I'd first start by reinforcing what I heard just before we went on, before you brought me on the air, and that is that there are no national standards. There's no national standards to guide or direct police agencies or police officers, certainly none that are helpful to the effort to make sure that we do not provide a hospitable place for white supremacists within the ranks. And when we look at the emails that have been exchanged, the other kinds to put it mildly, unprofessional behavior on the part of police officers, literally from coast to coast and border to border, we know that we've got a big, big problem. So we need to define that, I think, and set those standards and then enforce those standards. Now to your question. I think the federal government does a fairly good job in theory of defining white supremacist groups, neo-Nazi groups, any kind of extremist group that represents a threat of violence or property damage to any individuals or communities. But they're not understood by law enforcement agencies in general. They're not those standards are not enforced, I think, in general by law enforcement agencies.
We have the FBI reports from 2005 and 2015. I'm sorry, 2006 and 2015. Norm, you were a police officer for 34 years. You served as Seattle's chief of police. What kinds of conversations are you having with other officers and chiefs of police across the country specifically about this issue?
Well, I think the Charlottesville disaster has prompted a conversation that previously did not exist. I mean, it was not part of a national conversation, except among those who, like your other guests, are concerned about this issue and have been studying it and following it for a long time. So, but I can tell you from my experience that policing in general has not had any kind of given any kind of concerted attention to the issues of organized white supremacy, has not been spending time talking about the entry-level standards, the recruitment, the screening process used to determine who puts on what uniform in what city. And I think Charlottesville has sharpened the focus in general, but policing still lags.
Professor Jones, I know we have to let you go in a couple of minutes. If there is no attention to organized white supremacists in police departments, how do you think we need to tackle this issue? I mean, at a time when we're talking about things like unconscious bias, you know, professors going into police departments and talking with them about, you know, policing black communities, for example. I mean, we've done a lot of shows about that. How do you specifically tackle this issue?
So I think we have to hold police officers accountable. We have to understand that racial minorities, religious minorities pay the same amount of taxes as everybody else, and they're entitled to certain protections under the Constitution just like everyone else. And what's happening is that many police departments are very sympathetic to these groups, and I'll get into a couple of reasons why I think that there are some legal we have to do a better job in the legal community as well. But to answer your question, we have to hold police officers accountable. We have to start using the Freedom of Information Act, writing letters, being more public about what we are doing. We have to use social media, and we have to continue to do what you're doing on this show, having public discussions about these things, because we are educating the public, and we are educating certain departments who may not be aware that this is even a problem. But one of the things that I think law enforcement executives fear is violating the law. For instance, many police officers will get on social media and make comments that might indicate that they're in sympathy with white supremacist groups, or they might make racist comments and so forth, but they feel as though they have a First Amendment right to do that. They feel as though that they have the same right as everybody else to exercise to voice their concerns, and if their concerns are rooted in racial animus, they think that that's okay, and they have a First Amendment right to do that. Many police departments are unaware of how to combat that argument or that position. And so that in and of itself is a problem. The other problem is that many police officers know how to invent or create profiles on social media. They know that they can't use their own name because they are linked to a police department. So they create fictitious names, and they get on social media and they spread racial animus and so forth. And so one of the things that we can do as citizens, when we are electing district attorneys, when we are voting for all kinds of law enforcement officials, is to specifically ask them, you know, during the campaign process, or even for those who are currently in office, what are you doing to better screen your law enforcement officers? How are you policing their social media? What are the policies with respect to excessive force, sexual misconduct, racial misconduct, and start asking those questions. The more the public asks questions of the law enforcement leaders, the more they're going to know that they're going to have to be accountable to the public. And every state and county needs legislation that tracks the number of arrests and number of stops of racial minorities by their law enforcement. For instance, law enforcement shouldn't be allowed to simply just let everybody drive down the street and only stop minorities. We should be demanding a record of all of these interactions. How many houses have you raided, and what are the races of those people in those houses? What are their genders? And so we have to start asking more of these questions, and the more we ask of these questions and demand reports, the more police agencies will know that they either have to curtail this unlawful conduct or be exposed.
But Professor Jones, we're getting so many reports stating exactly what you just said. I mean, even in 1999, the ACLU had a piece, Driving While Black, Racial Profiling on Our Nation's Highways. We're now learning about what's happening in Baltimore, what happens in the Bay Area. I mean, as you said, from coast to coast. So what changes, are you seeing any changes as a result of all of these new reports that we now have access to?
What you're starting to see is some jurisdictions enact laws that require police officers to track the amount of people that they're stopping and the race and genders of those people and how long that stop exists. What you're also starting to see is better accountability with respect to so-called drug searches and who's being arrested for drugs and who isn't. And so there are some jurisdictions that actually are tracking these things. And what's interesting is that before President Obama left office, the Department of Justice was starting to conduct a series of investigations and issue reports as they did in Baltimore and Ferguson and Chicago and in Philadelphia. It doesn't appear that the current administration is very interested in using the Department of Justice in that manner. But what people can do, communities can do, they can hold their state officials accountable, because your state district attorney, your state attorney general can still launch investigations and force police officers to reveal that kind of information and track that kind of information. So that's what we're seeing now. Some district attorneys, attorney generals and district attorneys across the nation who care about this issue start to do, again, accountability, requiring them to report this information.
Professor Jones, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Samuel Jones is a professor at John Marshall Law School in Chicago. He wrote a piece in 2015 called Law Enforcement and White Power, an FBI Report Unraveled. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is A.C. Thompson, a reporter at ProPublica covering criminal justice and these issues, and Norm Stamper. He was a police officer for 34 years and served as Seattle's chief of police. He's now a writer and trainer focused on police reform and social justice policing. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about how law enforcement deals with white supremacists inside and outside police forces. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Leave a comment at Your Call Radio on Twitter or on our website, Your Call Radio. We have an email from Mike in El Cerrito. He says, if only a minority of police officers are racists or members of hate groups, can't the majority discipline them? Can we dismiss once and for all the bad apples defense of police departments? Or is the social marginalization of law enforcement officers creating a solidarity that overwhelms personally held ethics? Norm Stamper, what are your thoughts on that?
First thought is that it's a very insightful question. I think if we find ourselves talking about bad apples over and over and over again, it's time to look at the barrel. It's time to look at the structure of American policing. I do that in my latest book, and I think it's vital that we recognize that policing, in the absence of a true partnership with the citizens of the communities they're serving, doesn't have any hope whatsoever of eliminating the so-called bad apple. We need to radically reorganize American policing. Now, having said that, I think there's a good case to be made that peer pressure, which is probably the strongest form of, you know, organizational influence that you're going to find in any occupational setting, certainly in policing, offers great potential. But we've not unleashed it, and in fact, we've done the opposite. We've created, in effect, two cultures: the policing, the culture of the brass, and the culture of the rank and file. And rank-and-file officers are famous for telling their newbies, forget what they teach you in the academy, forget what the chief or the sheriff is saying. You're in the real world now, son, and this is the way we do police work in this city. And if the way we do police work in this city is racist, sexist, homophobic, if it plays loose and easy with the law, then that's the kind of policing you're going to get in that city, and the peer pressure will be oriented around exactly the wrong kinds of values.
A.C. Thompson, what would you add?
I think that's a really good point. And people have worked on this in places like New Orleans, the bystander training, right? So the idea is that if you have an officer who's engaged in misconduct, that you set up a culture where his or her fellow officers are encouraged to say, hey, stop that. That's not how we're going to conduct ourselves. That's not how we're going to behave as officers. And if you're going to keep going that way, you're going to be reported. I think that's a really, really good point. And I think that's a place absolutely where we seem to be falling down.
AC, you had a piece in November that you wrote with two colleagues at ProPublica called Hate Crime Training for Police is Often Inadequate, Sometimes Non-Existent. Only a fraction of bias crimes ever get reported. Fewer still get successfully prosecuted. Perhaps the widespread lack of training for frontline officers has something to do with that. Tell us more about what you found there.
Yeah, it was pretty stunning. So we looked at hate crimes training around the country and how it's conducted around the country. And I mean, the first thing to point out is that it varies dramatically from place to place. There are no national standards around police training. The amount of time you'll spend in the academy overall can vary dramatically depending on what county you're in and what state. But the next thing is when you look specifically at hate crimes, we found a lot of places that just don't do it at all. There's no requirement to train officers regarding hate crimes and how to respond to them, how to investigate them, how to amass evidence that can be used to prosecute. A lot of places where it's just not happening at all. The other thing that we saw was when departments are, through their post boards, what are called the Peace Officer Standard and Training Commissions or boards, are setting up standards around training to investigate hate groups. Again, the issue we saw there is that the material was dated. You know, it tend to be talking about groups like the Klan, groups like the Aryan Nations, groups like the neo-Nazi skinheads, and those were all threats and remain threats, but there are much bigger threats in the white supremacist movement now that are more current that I don't think most police departments are training their officers to respond to.
Norm Stamper, what explains this, especially now?
I think our values explain it. There's an attitude within law enforcement that basically says we're the cops and you're not. We've been at this for a long time. We know what we're doing. There are a lot of sort of references to ivory tower academic types or to journalists or to the occasional progressive police chief living in an unreal world. The cops would contend, hey, look, it's fine for you to talk about a theory. It's quite another to really understand what's going on in the real world. Most of the training that cops get, the real training that they get, is in the locker room or the front seat of a police car. And when you hear expressions like "forget what they taught you in the academy," what you're hearing in the next breath is, this is the way you be a cop in this city. I've heard the word standards. Can I just comment on that for one moment? We have 18,000 police departments or law enforcement agencies in this country. No single unifying set of standards. 18,000 agencies, one constitution. If we took just the procedural justice core of that constitution, not just what police officers are expected to do, but how they're expected to do it, and created standards around them, and I think of stop and frisk, writing of citations and traffic stops and arrests, rules of evidence, use of force, including lethal force. If we were to create solid, defensible standards for each and every one of those, then insist that every single police officer in this country meet or exceed those standards or find another line of work. Right now, for example, the officer who shot and killed Tamir Rice in Cleveland, Ohio, had been fired by the Independence, Ohio Police Department a couple of years prior. Why was he sacked? Because he fell apart on the police pistol range. He was an emotional wreck. His mother said that he cried himself to sleep over his academy manual at night. And this was a guy wearing a Cleveland police officer, a Cleveland badge pinned to his chest, and a lethal firearm strapped to his waist. And in fact, just a couple of years after he was fired, he shot and killed a lonely 12-year-old boy on a snowy field in Cleveland. We can prevent these kinds of incidents if we fire, and the professor was talking about this, I echo it strongly, if we fire police officers who have white supremacist tendencies, who engage in racial or ethnic slurs or any other brand of bigotry within the workplace or in their off-duty hours on social network. We have the right as a society to expect that our police officers behave responsibly. We have a right to demand that officers place the sanctity of human life as their number one priority. I talked to a cop a week ago who said, every time I suit up, every time I get in my car and drive out to my beat, I do so with this mentality. Nobody dies today. Nobody dies on my watch. That includes me as the officer. But this is an officer who has internalized and operationalized a philosophy that's consistent with what I think most Americans want to see in their cops. We can do that across the board. But we've got to be willing to fire a police officer who misbehaves, and in doing so, strip him or her of the license that would go with setting national standards. If you certify agencies and you license individual officers, you can decertify, and you can yank the license of an officer who can't or won't play by the rules.
AC, what are your thoughts about that, about firing police officers and what it will take? Because this hits close to home. We had the seven San Francisco police officers exchanging racist text messages in 2012, joking about cross burnings and advocating violence against African Americans. They kept their jobs after a court ruled the statute of limitations had expired. And in 2015, it happened again. They were suspended after an investigation revealed they exchanged numerous white power communications laden with remarks about lynching African Americans and burning crosses. So as Professor Jones said, I mean, this is happening coast to coast. What would you say about Norm's comments regarding firing and how that should happen?
I think he's hit on a, you know, absolutely central issue. And I think that we have been really bad about disciplining police officers in this country for decades. I think it's very, very difficult to fire a police officer in almost any department across the country. They tend to have quite good civil service protections. And what you tend to see is when discipline comes down, it gets reversed quite often by a police commission or a civil service board. And I think, you know, you can see this play out in San Francisco over and over and over again. It, you know, San Francisco is a progressive city that's been trying to do the right thing around policing for decades. And it still, to this day, has a very difficult time imposing any significant discipline on officers, let alone pushing them off the force when they probably should be. If San Francisco is having that much trouble, think about what's going on in other cities where there's perhaps less interest in doing that. So I think that's absolutely a crucial thing to do, is to be able to hold officers accountable when they engage in misconduct, get them off the force, and also to make sure that citizens have clear channels to make complaints, channels that will not lead to them being targeted by law enforcement or retaliation from law enforcement, and that there are early warning systems in place at police departments, so when an officer starts showing signs that they may be misbehaving, that before it escalates to a lethal incident, they either get retraining or discipline, or they get asked or forced to leave the force.
AC, what changes have you seen in police departments across the country on these issues?
You know, I think there's definitely more consciousness around this. You know, when we look at the police training stuff, we see a lot of departments that are now doing training around civil rights issues. They're doing training around cultural sensitivity. And that's great. And it's a massive improvement, right? You know, like I said, with the hate crimes, that's still a challenge. There's only 12 states that legally require police officers to get that training. And there's seven that don't require it at all. So I think there's definitely improvements, you know, the cultural sensitivity, the proper civil rights respecting policing. These are things that are coming in to police training and into police departments more and more. But we still have a lot of work to do.
Norm Stamper, what in terms of citizens getting involved in these issues, what would you say is most effective?
I think most effective is when the local law enforcement agency opens its doors and officers and offers a seat to citizens in all aspects of police operations, policymaking, program development, crisis management, teaching at the academy, and certainly citizen oversight, review of use of force, including especially lethal force. Citizens in a free and democratic society should recognize that the police belong to them, not the other way around. Police officers, of course, need to understand that and honor that, and in the process make their work more noble, and I would submit a hell of a lot safer over time. But the police have become, to too many people and too many agencies, an oppressive arm of a repressive establishment. White police officers in general, many, many exceptions, do not understand why so many black families have such mistrust, fundamental, profound mistrust of them. And they will say, well, you know, my father didn't own slaves, and my father's father's father didn't own slaves, and why am I being saddled with this allegation of racism and so forth? When you consider that American policing derives from the days of slave patrols, and a tainted history and an uninterrupted line of incidents of young black men, unarmed in many cases, being shot and killed by the police with a lousy defense for that, and nobody being held accountable, that creates this deep, deep mistrust. So I'm convinced that what has to happen is that the walls of the bureaucracy need to come down. We need to create, ultimately, it's not going to happen by Tuesday of next week, a seamless community police partnership in which public safety, neighborhood health, an honoring of civil liberties are the responsibility of the partnership, of the citizen police partnership. I had the distinction of presiding over the World Trade Organization battle in Seattle in 1999. And looking back on that experience and reflecting on it too many times to count, I can tell you I made very serious mistakes. One of them was using chemical agents on nonviolent, non-threatening protesters, my fellow Americans assembled to exercise their rights. And another was not making sure before we even went into that notorious week that the citizens of my city were meeting with my officers consistently in authentic partnership. No unilateral decision making, no arbitrary decision making. You know, the police not coming across as we're the cops and you're not, but rather as we're all in this together. It can be done. I do offer a way that it can be structured, but it takes a tremendous amount of work and it takes a fundamental shift in thinking. And we're in no immediate danger, I think, of entering that territory. But I think we need to push for it. We need to push through a massive citizens grassroots movement, this community police partnership. And if the invitation is not forthcoming from the local agency, then citizens should be demanding a seat at the table.
Norm Stamper was a police officer for 34 years and served as Seattle's chief of police. He's author of To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. A.C. Thompson is a reporter at ProPublica, covering criminal justice, hate crimes, and white supremacy groups. Norm and A.C., thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.